Slime Allocator project description is queued up and ready to go. We've run into a snag, which is shouldn't be your problem, but it's going to be. The snag is really silly. We have some benchmark data we have to collect. The machine that's used for this class is the only machine we have on which the benchmarks can be successfully run. So I'm in the process of swapping two machines. We're basically going to move our lab over onto what's normally the class machine, and then we're going to free up the lab machine for the class. I think I can get that done in the next 24, 48 hours. The practical consequence of this is that while I'm going to send out the project description so you can get started, we're not going to be able to provide a supporting machine for at least another 2 days. So the thing to do is to get started on this either on the departmental machines or on your own machines with the expectation that you'll be moving onto the class machine fairly quickly. The reason we need to do that is because the way we're going to go about grading this is we have a test program that we're going to run. I need to talk to Swaroop, but my memory is that last time we actually made the test program directly available to people in binary form to run for themselves along with a makefile to combine it with your work. Because of this delay, we're probably going to extend the due date from what we would normally do. And I don't want to set a due date until I know I've got the machine swapped, because if it goes an extra 2 days, you guys shouldn't be penalized for that. Roughly speaking, the intention of this project is that it should take about 2 weeks. And we'll stretch that a little bit because of this machine awkwardness. And by the way, that's been a lot of what's been the source of the delay here, was figuring out what we're going to do about this. And I have a note on my machine downstairs that's actually ready to send, but it hasn't been sent yet. And just to give you a sense of it, what we've done is we have a header file that basically says, you're going to implement a variant of the slab allocator. We have a header file that says, here's the interface that your allocator should implement. Now, it's going to end up being a little bit different than the one that's implemented by the official slab allocator, because in order to test your implementation, we've added some extra interfaces that expose some attributes of your implementation. Normally, if you were just doing this as a library, you wouldn't expose these extra interfaces, but these let us do things like measure the amount of fragmentation you've got. And that'll change your implementation from what would happen if you were just doing the vanilla interface. So that's what's coming. I want to start in on concurrency. First, let me say that there is no problem with concurrency per se. This line is in the topic area is slightly misnamed. The problem comes when you have concurrency and writable shared memory at the same time. If you and I are both reading something and neither of us is modifying it, there's no problem with concurrency. The thing isn't changing, and so there's no issue of consistency. When things start changing and we start accessing them at the same time, now we start to have a mess. So, as a sort of naive example, suppose we have two threads. They're sharing memory, and so they're both in the same address space, and it happens that they're both running the same procedure. And the procedure is the one on the slides and the one I've got on the board. And it's simple enough, right? What I'm going to do is I'm going to read a single character from the input, I'm going to copy it, and I'm going to write the copy to the output. So these two threads are going to do this at the same time. And what's going to happen? Remember, the rule is that when we're talking about kernel scheduled threads, you can get interrupted between any two steps. So
So suppose that the two characters that get typed in are a C followed by a D. What's going to come out? So two possibilities are that I could get out a C followed by a D, or I could get out a D followed by a C, right? This is the theory that I don't know what order they're going to operate in, and they could get preempted, so the order in which they come in could end up being different from the order in which they come out. Does everybody see how I could get the D followed by a C? See at least one puzzle book. So the first process does a read and gets the C. It now gets preempted. The second process does a read and gets the D. And before it gets preempted again, it gets all the way to the right, outputting the D. Now there's nothing left to do, so the first process runs again, and it goes all the way through and writes the C. So as a consequence of preemption, the visible output can get reordered. Good.
They share variables.
Yeah. Yes. It's not clear that the DC output can happen. Let's go through that case again. Good. First process reads a C, and it puts it in. Second process reads a D. Where does it go? Goes into N. And the second process proceeds, and it goes ahead and emits the D to the screen. Now we go back to the first process, which now proceeds to read N, which contains what?
D.
So in fact, it's altogether possible that the sequence of output we'll see is DD. It turns out we could see the case of DC. Maybe. Can we? If the second thread runs first all the way through, then the second thread is going to get the C, and it will emit the C first. So is it possible to see DC?
I think so.
No. Okay. Is it possible to see CC? Steps in which the C comes out first, but the variable doesn't get clobbered. So change the problem a little bit. Yeah.
I'm confused by the DC kind of happens. I mean, how do you know that it's not in the register already when you go to the problem?
There are no registers here. These are shared memory variables.
Oh.
So change the problem slightly. Suppose in is a local variable. It's not going to be in shared memory anymore. We're going to put it on the stack of a particular thread, or we're going to put it in a register.
thread. But out is still a shared memory variable. Well, could we still see CD? That story didn't change, right? That was the simple story in which they executed sequentially without interleaving. But now it turns out we can see DC. Here's why. First thread reads the scene in the end, which is local. Second thread now runs. It reads the D, it clobbers out with the D, it writes the D, therefore we see D first. First thread now resumes, copies its local value in, which holds C, to the shared variable out, which now holds C, and then writes it, emitting C again.
Is colon equals assignment or concatenation?
Assignment. Colon equals assignment. Could we see DD? How? What's the sequence?
You read C, you copy it to out, and then you get preempted.
The first thread gets preempted now, here, before it has a chance to run. Now
then the second thread reads in D, copies it to out, and outputs it to the screen, so it runs all the way through, and then it returns to the first thread, whose out variable is now D.
Yes.
It's D to the screen.
So now I can see DD. And I can lose the C altogether. And just for grins, is it possible to get CC out of this mess if N is a local variable? I see not. How are we going to do it?
So first process reads in, then it gets preempted, then the second process reads in D, it gets
if we copy it to out, we're never gonna see C.
Not get preempted in after out.
Oh, I'm sorry, you're absolutely right. Okay. So first guy reads C locally and gets preempted. Second guy reads D locally, stores it in the global variable, and gets preempted. Now what? First guy runs again, clobbers the global variable, and now by the time they get around to a meeting, both of them, what they see in the global variable is C. If your head is starting to hurt, the fun is only beginning. So, this is a mess. And it's a very deceptive mess in which the kinds of twisted reasoning you have to do about what's going to happen are very, very hard for humans to do.
We're assuming here you only have one processor. What would this model look like if you had more than one?
More than one what?
More than one processor.
More than one CPU.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Because if those CPUs are executing other activities, so it's not so much that we assume that we had only one CPU, as that we assumed a particular interleaving of execution of these two particular programs, right? So if I have more than one CPU, look, I've probably got other things going on in the system. Now those things are unrelated, except that they serve to cause these programs to pause at certain points in their execution streams. And because of the timing and the resulting interleaving, we get alterations in behavior because of that interference. Okay, so this is horrible. And so, what we need is a way to control this kind of concurrency. Right? What we have here is an inconsistency resulting from an uncontrolled update, where two parties are doing updates, and then they're using the variables, and they haven't established sufficient control over who's going to do what in what order. So what we need here is something that has come to be referred to in the literature as a critical section.
Okay. And the idea is that each process is going to do its operations inside a region that it exclusively owns. So what we're going to do is we're going to tie these updates to a code region. And so the pattern is that we're somehow going to make a mark that we're all going to know how to interpret. All the threads know how to interpret this mark that says, I am entering the critical section. It's mine now. When I'm done with the critical section, I will then announce that I have exited the critical section. And then I'll go on to do the remainder of my computation. If you come to enter the critical section while I'm in it, you'll see that I'm in the critical section and you will wait. At least in the naive pattern, what happens is that there is a repeat until you get to enter the critical section. Right? The slide shows you looping over this whole sequence, but that's not really what happens. So the model is, I'm going to try to enter the critical section. If I can't enter the critical section, then I'm basically going to go loop trying. And eventually I'll get in because you'll get out. Is that really true? Suppose my scheduling is non-preemptive. Are you going to get out?
Who knows?
Oh, I know. You're not going to get out. You're not going to get out because I'm looping. And I'm not going to stop looping until you're out. But I'm not going to be preemptive to let you run because the scheduling is not preemptive. So I will loop forever.
But what if you, what about when your time slice comes out?
Not preemptive. No time slice.
That's silly.
Yes, that was the point. All right, what about if the scheduling is preemptive? Will this work?
Maybe.
That sounds really very confident and certain.
Well, no.
You're getting to know me far too well, but
if
you want to take a position here and try to hold it.
Well, it depends on what's going on in the critical section. If something in the critical section is waiting for something else.
Have you ever argued with a rabbi? Right? You ask a rabbi a question, the answer is always, well, it depends. Having almost been a rabbi, right, I can make a limited supply of rabbi jokes. It's always not too offensive, but especially with him. Anyway, okay, so it depends. So on the one hand,
if something that's happening in the critical section is dependent on something from the thread that's looping, for sure, then and the thread that's
okay, we haven't gotten there yet. We're going to deadlock. All I want to know is, are we going to get into the critical section? How's that going to work out? You've got it. I'm looping for it. How in hell are you going to get clear of it?
You eventually get preempted.
Eventually, I'm going to get preempted, right? And eventually, you'll get to continue executing, and eventually, you'll clear the section. And then I'll get to go into it, maybe. The next time I'm around. Well, turns out that the answer was maybe. So, because of the ordering of scheduling, there's actually no guarantee that I'll ever get into the critical section. Right? I'll be looping for it. I'll get preempted. While I'm preempted, I'm not looping for it. You get out of it. Somebody else gets scheduled ahead of me. They grab it. Now I come along and somebody else is in the damn critical section. Right? We're engaged in this funny kind of a race in which there's some arbitrariness about who goes in what order. So there are two things that we want to do here. One, we don't want to spin forever. That would be stupid. So we'd like a mechanism that cooperates with the scheduler. So the model is, when I go to spin for a lock, part of what's going to happen is if I can't get it, somehow the operating system is going to know that, and instead of just letting me spin forever, I will voluntarily give up the processor. Why? I can't make any progress until I get the lock anyway. I might as well let you get out of the way. And there are some efficiency issues with this, but we'll talk about them. So what do we really need? Well, we need three things. We need to ensure that only one party runs inside the critical section at a time. That's called mutual exclusion. We need to know that if somebody wants to enter the critical section, and the critical section is not currently occupied, then somebody will enter the critical section. They can't be postponed indefinitely. You can't solve the problem by not letting anybody in at all. In fact, you need to be able to characterize what the bound is on how long it will take. And that's the last requirement, which is you want bound and waiting. So, if I request to enter the critical section, there needs to be some bound on how many people might get there ahead of me, because otherwise I might never get there. And that's especially true in a system with static priorities, because if a low priority process requests entry to a critical section, and high priority processes progressively come along and enter it, that low priority process may never get in. Now there's a catch there. Suppose the low priority process does get in. Well, we now have a situation where the low priority process owns the critical section, and now there might be a high priority process trying to get in. The high priority process is now queued up behind the low priority process. We have just inverted the priority scheme. In some sense, that low priority process is now more important than the high priority process. This is called priority inversion, and it's an intrinsic property of any kind of mutual exclusion scheme that by virtue of accident, it could be that a lower priority party gets there first and blocks a higher priority party.
All right.
So, how are we going to do this? There are both software and hardware solutions, and I really ought to do this with an overhead projector, but let's see how far we get. So, the first solution, let me say, all these solutions that I'm about to consider are two-thread solutions. Some of them have generalizations, but let's do it for two threads. If we can't do it for two threads, no point worrying about three. So the first approach is, well, what we'll do is we'll introduce a shared variable called turn. Okay? And so turn is a Boolean. It's allowed to take on the value 0 and 1. It's initially 0. And we're going to do a big loop, and the loop is going to say,
let me just write it out and I'll talk through it. So here's the idea. I and J are local variables. They're not shared. So I, from the perspective of each process, I is always me, and J is always the other process. And what we're going to do is we're going to number the processes. So, for process 0, I equals 0, J equals 1. And for process 1, I equals 1 and J equals 0. Is this going to work? Assuming we've got preemption. If I'm process 1, what's going to happen? Suppose process 1 runs first. What's going to happen at the while loop? What's the initial value of turn? 0. So in process 1, what's the value of I? In process 1, value of I is 1. Right, so I is always my own number, J is always the other guy's number. So if process 1 gets into this first, then process 1 is going to hit the while loop. It's not process 1's turn, and so process 1 is going to wait, which takes the form of looping on a no-op. Now process 0 tries. What happens then? What's the value of I in process 0?
Zero.
What's the value of turn when process 0 comes in?
Zero.
Hasn't changed yet, so it's still 0. Okay. So process 0 is going to come in, and turn equals I, so we're not going to no op, we get the critical section. We go ahead and do it. And now we give the turn to somebody else. Specifically, we give it explicitly to the other process. Okay. And now we loop again. We're still in process 0, but now what's the value of turn?
One.
So now process 0 is going to get to this while loop, and it's going to fail the check, and it's going to loop. Eventually, it'll get preempted, and process 1 will get to go. And now process 1, which is still in this loop, right, is checking turn. And now the condition is correct for it to proceed, and process 1 will get to run the critical section. And process 1 will exit the critical section, and it will give the turn back to process 0. So we're going to do a ping pong thing here. Okay. So, does this achieve mutual exclusion?
Yeah, no one's ever in the critical section.
Only one process is in there at the same time, right? Does it guarantee progress?
Yeah.
relying on the preemption mechanism. And if progress were in fact guaranteed, then this would work. But I don't know why it doesn't guarantee progress. It doesn't guarantee progress. In the absence of preemption, it does not guarantee progress.
Okay. So the problem here is if process one happens to come along first, then process one will loop forever, and process zero will never get a turn.
You keep saying about relying on preemption to exit a process when it tries
not to exit, to preempt.
Yeah, when it tries to enter a critical section. Why isn't it when it enters a critical section and it's already locked? Why doesn't the operating system automatically stop it right at that?
Because we haven't talked to the operating system. The operating system has no idea we're doing this. We're just manipulating memory.
But when you call that API to enter a critical,
there is no API. We're just manipulating memory.
Oh, okay.
It's a pure software solution. What you're going to is there ought to be an API, and we ought to do something more intelligent than this. And I agree. We're going to get to that.
This doesn't necessarily guarantee progress. It only does if you assume that both threads are going to hit this portion of code.
Yes.
If thread one gets here first, and thread zero never comes to this piece of code, thread one will never continue.
Everybody see that? Suppose process zero never comes here. Process one will wait forever.
Okay, what can we do about it? Well, let's try refining this. So now what we'll do is we'll take this turn variable out and we'll introduce a flag variable, okay, which is an array of booleans, and we'll initialize them both to false. And we're going to change the loop so it starts comes in and sets its own flag value to true. And then it says, while the other guy's flag value is true, wait. And then when we get all the way through the critical section, set my flag value to false, saying, so I'm done.
If both guys set their own flag values to true, and then they end up waiting on the other guy, couldn't they wait there forever?
When two trains are scheduled to come to a crossing within 5 minutes of each other, both must halt, and neither can continue until the other comes out of sight. Passes out of sight. Right. There is the progress in this situation is really quite bad. We might make no progress at all, even if both guys show up for the party. And if we're not going to make progress, the question of whether we're going to make progress in bounded time, of course, is not very exciting. So, there's a third software solution, and this one actually works. It's called the Peterson solution. We're going to combine the two ideas, OK?
Okay, so what we're going to do is we're going to use both a term value and a flag variable. So, the problem here was we needed a tiebreaker. And that's what the term variable is doing. So the case where we failed to make progress was where each guy waited on the other. And we're going to use the term variable to break the tie. So we will make progress. And turns out we'll make progress in bounded time. This is called Peterson's algorithm. And it has an extension called the Makery algorithm, which is a generalization for n processes. And the idea is we're going to give each process an identifier, and the identifiers are ordered. And basically, the process with the smallest number gets to enter the section. And the tiebreaker is done using the process ID. Okay, so and actually, I'm not going to cover the degree of because it's not used in practice. The important aspect of the Makery algorithm is by imposing an ordering. Right? So what we really did here is the turn is acting kind of as a flip-flop to decide who wins in a tie. We need to generalize the who wins trick so that it works for multiple processes. And what the Makery algorithm does is it comes up with a clever technique just assign an ordering to the processes that can be used to resolve time. So I want to urge you to look at those slides on the handouts because you can bet that's going to show up on a midterm somewhere. And look at Peterson's algorithm and then look at the Makery algorithm and compare them. In reality, all of these are pretty horrible mechanisms. So the idea that I need a tiebreaker, the idea that I'm going to need to manage this for multiple processes, all of that's fine. But in practice, I want something a little better than this, because I don't want to have to wait for the preemption. So option number one, I will disable interrupts. By disabling interrupts, I disable the timer. By disabling the timer, I disable preemption. By disabling preemption, I guarantee that I will get to the end of the critical section, assuming I get into it at all. There are fairness problems with this, but it works. And in fact, it's the most common technique used in uniprocessor kernels. Or at least it used to be. It no longer is, because nowadays all of those kernels include the necessary code for multiprocessors as well, and they've largely abandoned that technique. It's not even correct on a multiprocessor because on a multiprocessor, when I disable interrupts, I'm disabling interrupts for my CPU, but not necessarily for your CPU. All right, so option number two is an operation called test and set. So here's what this does. It's a single atomic operation. It goes to memory, and I'm going to give you a simplified description. It doesn't actually work this way. It goes to memory and says, is this location currently zero? If so, set it to one and return success. If it is not currently zero, leave it alone and return failure.
This is all done in a single hardware-imposed atomic operation. Atomic means it is not divisible. It can't be interrupted in the middle. It's a single instruction. Okay, and this means that at the hardware level, I have a direct operation that doesn't involve any loops that's enough to make a note that I've entered the critical section. This doesn't resolve who's going to win if there's a tie, but it does let us grab the critical section. The actual implementation of it is usually done with a bit manipulation, not a word manipulation, but that's fine print. So, okay. There's an operating system solution which is generally built on top of this in a multiprocessor, which is called a semaphore. Okay, so the idea is, instead of running this algorithm that's going to loop for a long time, I'm going to drop it in the operating system, I'm going to do a system call, and I'm going to make it the operating system's problem. The operating system has an advantage. The advantage is it's in charge of who gets preempted, and so it's in a position to say, well, look, I'm doing this operation, then now would be a bad time to preempt. I just won't, I'll wait. So that's called a semaphore. And now what happens is, before I enter the critical section, I do what's called a wait on the semaphore. The semaphore, by the way, is often referred to as a mutex for mutual exclusion. You won't actually see that term very often in real code, but in the literature you'll see that term. So the two classic operations on a mutex are wait and release. Sorry, wait and signal. You'll also hear them referred to as P and V because they were introduced by Dijkstra, and those turn out to be first letters of wait and signal. In Dutch, I think? Don't hold me to that. Okay, so now what's going to happen is we're going to go to the operating system and say, I would like the critical section. Tell me if I got it, and if I didn't get it, I want to sleep until I got it. And now inside the operating system, we're going to solve the race by just not preempting until we get this figured out. And then we're going to do tiebreakers by using some kind of an ordering policy. But because the operating system is in on the joke, we don't have to rely on preemption to get us out of this mess. There are two kinds of semaphores. One's called a binary semaphore. It's either grabbed or it's not. It takes on two values, 0 and 1. And I think what I'm going to do is I'm going to start on counting semaphores tomorrow. So let me talk a minute about binary semaphores. So the semaphore only guards the critical section by virtue of software convention. We're relying on the idea that all the programs are going to play nicely, and they're all going to try to grab the semaphore before they enter the critical section. And they're either going to get it or they're not going to get it. And if they don't get it, they're going to queue. This can be integrated with language-level support. So there's a language-level construct called a monitor. And it says, here's a piece of code, and this piece of code, this region of code, should only be entered by one thread of control at a time. And the language actually attempts to grab the semaphore for you and simply won't let you run that piece of code. Right? So it uses scoping to enforce the check, so there's no error possible. Let me ask you a nasty question. How long should I be in a critical section? Should
critical sections be short, long, doesn't matter, what?
As short as possible.
As short as you can make it, what? What?
Because if you're sharing them, you don't want other processes to wait. You want to minimize your blocking time.
Those processors, I don't really care if they wait. I'm getting my job done. Why do I care if they wait?
The process wouldn't care, but the operating system designer might care.
Oh, you know, I'm the OS designer. I don't really care if your processes run fast or not. That's about politics and marketing. There's a correctness issue hiding in here. Why do I care? Suppose the process I'm blocking is higher priority than me. The longer I block it, the more screwed up the system's going to be. There's a reason that other process is higher priority. It's doing something that matters. If it didn't need to be faster than me, it wouldn't, and I'm in the way until I get out of the critical section. So one reason to keep critical sections short is to avoid priority inversion. It turns out there's another reason. Go ahead, yeah, what?
By temporarily escalating priorities for processes that are in a critical area, couldn't you avoid?
There's a technique called priority escalation. The idea is, if I'm a high priority process and I hit a critical section and you're in it and you're a low priority process, the thing to do, let you run on my priority until you get out of the way. It's called priority escalation. And it relies on some assumptions about the relationships around critical regions that don't always turn out to be right. But it's probably the best technique we've currently got. I can do that. All right. Why else do I want to keep the code in the critical section short?
You're just as likely to be the waiter as the waitee.
Yeah, so?
So, good neighbor.
That's not good neighbor. You know, good neighbors are people who donate their house to you, right? Now, why do I want to keep the code short? What happens when I run lots of code?
Cache.
Yeah, the performance issues. What else happens when I run lots of code? I fail. I crash. I do something wrong. What happens when you do something wrong inside a critical section? Suppose a process manages to shoot itself in the head inside a critical section. Right? It does a null pointer reference. Can we recover? Obviously, that process is now has gone south for the winter, right? Can the other threads that are attempting to use this data structure recover?
The OS is keeping track of locks that a process has, then when the OS realizes that a process has exited,
good. So the first part of recovery is, well, can we arrange that somebody else will now be able to get into the critical section? The answer is yes. If this is an OS-supported semaphore, we can notice that the process is dead, and we can release the semaphore on its behalf. After all, if we're the operating system and it's dead, that's because we killed it. Good. So now the second thread is in the critical section. Can it do anything meaningful in the critical section? Get fired? Probably not. Look, this semaphore here, it wasn't here to keep these processes from running at the same time. That wasn't what it was about.
What it was about was we had some data structure where if we had two processes manipulating the data structure at the same time, the data structure was going to get screwed up. The purpose of the semaphore was to give us some discipline that would allow us to maintain consistency. The reason this section is called critical is because the sequence of operations is critical to making some data structure, to making a consistent change on some data structure. And we've just said that somebody died halfway through a sequence of steps where if they didn't all go to completion the right way, the data structure was no longer consistent.
Every time, like, you could, every time someone entered a critical section, store the last consistent state of that data structure, and at least then you have something to recover to.
Maybe. Maybe. What if I die halfway through storing the consistent state? What if it's a data structure that involves complex pointer relationships? How do I undo all of that? I mean, there are some examples of algorithms where we can do that. We can do transactional things, right? And you can back the changes out if you're willing to pay that much. But you better not mess up recording the completion or failure of the transaction. That really is critical. Certainly the OS, in the absence of support from the application, is not in a position to back the application out. So there is actually a general and very hard problem with recovery if something fails inside a critical section. And in the general case, if somebody dies inside the critical section, you're going to get left with a progressively stinkier corpse until you kill all the participating processes. All right, we'll come back on this tomorrow.